Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with the one, the only, Peter Lowe. He's an employment attorney with Brian Isaacson. He's a regular here on the HR Power Hour. And we're going to be talking to him about protecting your company's reputation, lessons you can learn from Deflategate. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM. And today we're talking with Peter Lowe. He's an employment attorney with the firm Braun and Isaacson. Peter, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome back, I should say. Gosh knows you've been on the show many a time, and we would say a crowd favorite.
Well, I can find my way here now. That's
that is half the battle. Half the battle. You know, obviously, one of the things that we've talked about many times on the show is making sure that a company does the right thing. And I've always been under the belief that 99% of the time, owners want to do the right thing. There are occasionally things that happen that maybe they don't, but in the most cases, they always want to. We're going to talk about reputation today and how to, in fact, protect your company's reputation. And obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about Deflategate as a way into that conversation. But talk to me a little bit how these little small things creep up and they can become so big so fast. How can it happen that an employer can find themselves in this kind of trouble so quickly?
Well, I think times have changed. You and I have been doing this for a while, Dave, working with employers. And I think one of the biggest changes, state the obvious, is the amount of media coverage, whether it be social media, whether it be online reports, whether it be media, whether it be people just emailing back and forth. There's just this enormous volume and flow of information. So we see it in our practice when something at first appears relatively minor that an employer is dealing with, if not handled carefully and appropriately, can sometimes just blow up and explode. And it's hard to manage once that happens.
Yeah, there's no question that today's social media trends have made it harder and kind of made it public but yet private, because there are a lot of information that goes between employees that may have been just spoken before, and now it's all in writing.
Right. Well, you know, the Deflategate example, if I can go to that right away, because it really ties into what you just said. For those of us who have followed the travails of Tom Brady, our favorite son here in New England.
Absolutely.
And the Patriots, there wouldn't be any Deflategate if it were not for texts. And right at the heart of this whole Deflategate mess that has continues to go through the courts, there was a filing yesterday by Brady's new high-powered defense team. But it comes down to a couple of texts between, for want of a better term, the ball boys at Gillette Stadium. And millions of dollars were spent investigating Deflategate by the NFL's lawyers. And some few texts really lie at the heart of the allegations. So, we say it so often. I do in training. I know you do. For employers, where they have to be extra vigilant is what they put in their emails, in their texts. And I'm not suggesting that we're going to be conspiratorial and we're trying to conceal information, but a few lines, as we know, in an email or in a text can be so misunderstood, can be so misconstrued. Some of us try to be funny from time to time. It may work when we're speaking face-to-face or even in this forum like the radio, but you try that in a text form an email form, and it really can go awry at times.
This goes back to the old line that when, you know, written form of communication is one of the worst forms because it's interpreted many different ways, which is a little bit different than at least when you're watching somebody and you're talking to somebody, you can look in their eyes, you can watch body language, you can other things. There's other cues, but writing is writing.
Right.
And a word has many different potential meanings and or interpretations. And you know, that does make this part of the challenge, right, when we're talking about texting and email and social media and PR, if you want to say, for a company.
Right. And the word that was used in some of these texts between ball boys, one word was the deflator. It was used actually about 8 months before the AFC championship game, which is the whole focus of the allegations that balls were deflated. But what does that word mean in that text 8 months before? I've read that one of the ball boys stated that he was losing weight and was on a diet. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. I wasn't there. But it's remarkable how so much focus can be paid on one word or one term. And when we have the benefit of hindsight, we're terribly wise. But
that's true.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's back up for a minute. And so since we're talking about a company's reputation and we're talking about Deflategate, I know that you are from England. All those who are listening know that this is Peter's real accent, even though we always kid him and say it's fake. He's from England. So you know football a little differently, correct?
I do. As I said, the real football, let's face it, the game played with the round ball. So it's dangerous if you get me started on that subject, Dave. As you know, I can talk about it at some length. I recently spoke on this Deflategate subject at the HR convention, a wonderful convention in
Salisbury. It was great. It was a great convention, yeah.
I know Dave is always very, very active there as well. And I gave folks a little bit of a lesson on the real football as well.
I saw that lesson. Yeah. Yes, I did.
There's been this wonderful story in the past few months for those of us who follow football in the English sense, and this tiny sort of minnow of a team has won the English Premier League Championship. The name is Leicester City. And there's so many facets to this story that relate to employers, employment, employees. On a football team, you have 11 players on the pitch. That's the field, by the
pitch.
Way. I'll do a little bit of translating.
Thank along. You. Please help translate, yes.
At times, you could look at the team that Leicester were fielding, and they had 11 different nationalities from all over the world. And we talk so often appropriately about the issue of diversity in the workplace, the importance of diversity. Sometimes it can be a little amorphous and say, well, what does that really look like? And frankly, if you look at that team and you look at players from Australia and Argentina and Jamaica and Ghana and England and Holland, it's pretty remarkable. And the other aspect of that group, where they were a ragtag, misfit, has-been, journeyman, all those terms were used to describe them, yet they came together, and they came together. It's not going to surprise you and with your background. They came together under a leader, and a remarkable leader, who this 64-year-old Italian gentleman by the name of Claudio Ranieri. And I could talk for an hour about Claudio Ranieri and some of his stories, but it really did illustrate, you know, that whole concept of bringing together a group of folks with different skills, different backgrounds, different nationalities in that instance, and when led by somebody who was inspirational, passionate, and a true leader, it was a remarkable story. If you'll let me tell one other aspect of that story.
Of course.
Because I love history, and I think a little folklore is fascinating. This team, Leicester City, is... it's right in the heart of England. It's really known for nothing. other than being sort of a, almost like a rest stop on one of the big highways in England. But about a year ago, the body of Richard III, who was the last English king to die in battle, I may get my date wrong, but I think it was 1485, his body was found under a car park, parking lot translation. Parking lot.
Thank you for the
and
translation. Thank you.
It was the most inauspicious place for a king's body to be found. It literally had been dumped there. It was recovered and removed and put in a place of honor in Leicester Cathedral last year, March of 2015. The football team in that same community, the one I've been talking about, essentially has gone on this unparalleled streak ever since that time. So the myth, the folklore, the legend is having finally paid respect to Richard III and put him in a place where he deserves to be, that they've reversed, if you like, the curse. So there's a lot of fun aspects to that particular real football story.
Well, you know, I guess lesson, right?
Yeah.
With the right leader, you can pull together any team.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And one other fact, they were playing teams with resources that were 10, 15, 20 times the resources they had, the amount of their payroll, the amount they would spend. Yet, ultimately, they won. It was cool.
And, of course, that makes you happy.
Extremely happy.
I figured as much. Well, you know, we've talked about many times that a company is only as good as the team that it has on the field, right? Playing, or if you call, what was field again?
Pitch.
Pitch, on the pitch. So you've learned something today, folks. You've learned that pitch means field in English. Yeah, I know. I'm confused as well. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM, presented by CMAcareer.com. And we are back with Peter Lowe, employment attorney at Brown and Isaacson. We're talking about dealing with a company's reputation, and certainly we're talking about Deflategate as an example of that. Peter, you know, reputation is all we really have at the end of the day. And a company has a reputation whether they like it or not. Right? I mean, out there in the world, a company has a reputation, a person has a reputation. It may be good, it may be bad, it may be indifferent. But reputation means a lot for hiring people, especially today's day and age where we're trying to get great talent. And it's a reputation of how people are treated. It's a reputation of how people are let go. I mean, all the way through the process, it's a reputation. Some CEOs don't see it that way, or they don't necessarily do the right things sometimes. And I know you have some examples you want to share, but you know, give me your interpretation of reputation and what that means from a maybe a legal perspective, or how that really comes out, and people need to deal with that.
Well, in the interest of elevating your show to new heights, I may quote Shakespeare here.
Wow.
Shakespeare describes reputation as the immediate jewel of the soul. Warren Buffett put it slightly more simply, which is, it takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. He went on to say, if you think about that, you'll do things differently. If you really look and think about both of those quotations, there is something irreplaceable about a reputation. It is something that a company or an individual, we're going to talk about CEOs in a minute, spend a lifetime building, burnishing, polishing, presenting, and we're all only too familiar with the spectacular falls from grace that can happen, and that can happen on a corporate level or an individual level. To state the obvious, avoiding those situations, and I think we may talk about some sexual harassment situations, avoiding them in the first place is a massive reason to safeguard a reputation. For a company, often, it's not only the behavior, the antics, the mistakes that create the headline, it's then how it responds to those issues. And you know, you and I know instances where, frankly, the cover-up or the failure to address can cause as much reputational harm as the underlying behavior. Look no further than one of the subjects I've spoken about before on this show, Penn State. The underlying conduct was deplorable, reprehensible, abominable. The response and reaction of the institution, of the university, compounded their problems to a massive degree. So there's those different aspects to reputation and reputational harm and protecting one's reputation.
Well, you know, we've talked about reputation before, certainly in the context of companies need to know what theirs is to deal with it in the situation. But you have some examples of executives that who should be above the fray, but didn't necessarily make it above the fray, you know, and how they dealt with it the wrong way. And I guess to your point, it isn't really about just them not doing the right thing, right? They did something wrong. Mm-hmm. It's also how a company handles it, because HR professionals sometimes are concerned about how they're going to deal with the CEO, yeah. Right? They're concerned about their jobs on the line. What if I, don't handle it well? You know, this is a real concern for them.
It really is. And in preparing my presentation on this topic recently, I thought, well, I'll do a little research and see if I can find some examples of CEOs who've found themselves in hot water. The good or perhaps the bad news was there was no shortage. I just did a CEO harassment scandal search, and they fall out of the trees. And there's a couple that I can focus on, not to point fingers at anybody, but because they illustrate how difficult these issues end up being, particularly for HR. Because if you think about it, when the dean of a law school, in this case it was a law school in California, is accused of sexual harassment, how HR and the senior administration deals with that can be very, very tricky. And in that particular instance, the dean allegedly was being very affectionate to his executive assistant, hugs and kisses. And at least, again, the allegations, this case never went through to trial, but the allegations presented were that there was widespread knowledge of that. And the inference from that situation is that folks were reluctant to deal with it and didn't know how to deal with it. And if you look at it closely, there's an inherent built-in conflict of interest, because the HR director may not report directly, sometimes they will, but not directly to the CEO or the dean in this case, but they're in the reporting chain, and that can create great problems and stresses and difficulties for that individual. There's another case, and it really just happened in the last few months as well, very major advertising company, Walter Thompson, and ultimately SEO resigned in a cloud of allegations about statements that he had made and a lawsuit that was filed by one of his executive team. And what you see in those cases, and frankly a whole number of other cases that I looked at involving major corporations, is almost always the allegation that the company did not do enough to respond. When the case blew open, when the court filing happened and it became public and it's reported by the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, then there's a scramble. Then there's the public relations crisis. And in almost all the cases I was looking at, It's shortly followed by the resignation of the CEO. So the perilous waters. I call that person, for want of a better term, the top dog. And how do you deal with allegations against the top dog?
But the top dog could also be the best salesperson or the best producer for the company, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be the CEO.
That's a great, great point. Yeah, it's somebody who is a great rainmaker for the company, somebody who's a key employee. And I think experience has shown us that there can be a reluctance in some organizations to deal with that issue. And one of the things that I've talked about, certainly advise clients at the right time, is there may be the need to bring in someone from the outside to investigate. It could be time for an outside investigator when HR may find themselves compromised or at least the perception of a conflict of interest. And so that's one practical step that organizations should think about when they find themselves in that spot.
You know, we have seen certainly, and you have as well, that there are certain things or patterns, if you want to say, that happen in these circumstances. You know, things like reluctance to report or, failure to completely investigate. What are some of the other patterns that you've seen that companies fall into, right, when they're dealing with this? And by the way, we're talking with Peter Lowe. He's an employment attorney with Brown & Isaacson. And we're talking about dealing with an employee or dealing with a company's reputation. And we're going to talk about Deflategate next here, having to do with this. But what are some of the patterns you see, Peter?
Yeah, one of the things I've seen is when one of these cases breaks against a top dog. So that quite often is the filing of a lawsuit, and it's being dealt with internally, and then a lawsuit's filed. You will fairly frequently see the company and perhaps the person who's accused, let's say the chief executive, come out with these very strong categorical denials. And those are hard to walk back at times. And so you see the company taking a strong position. It may even be a position that is aggressive towards the person who's making those accusations. Then in a number of these cases, you later see that there are cracks in that vigorous denial, and no more so than in many of these instances when the CEO then resigns under pressure from the board, from the shareholders, as the story gets traction. And then I think, you know, the company reputationally has suffered harm in several ways. It suffered harm by the belief that the conduct occurred. That's certainly the inference you can see from a CEO resignation. And also by its then shift in position, because there's a fundamental credibility issue, you know, all corporations, all institutions have, is if you say one thing one day and then your message seems to be different the next day, I don't think any public relations consultant will say that's a good idea. But that was a frequent pattern. One other thing that you do see in some of these cases is initially when the case has been dealt with, the claim, the allegation internally, the consequences for the top dog are relatively modest and nominal. And I mentioned the law school dean case that occurred in this last year. I read about that case, and originally the internal investigation resulted in the dean's salary being reduced by 10%. A well-paid guy, I think over $400,000, to reduce his salary by 10% for engaging in inappropriate conduct, potentially harassing conduct, seemed a little bit like a slap on the wrist. The story broke, it became public, and as I think I mentioned already, he then resigned from his position. So you had this sort of drastic shift as there was the glare of publicity in that case. And there are other examples.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a very common tactic, right? They try to do a minimal technique to try to, you know, sweep it under the rug a little bit. And, you know, you've spoken before about Penn State. I mean, this classic example of a reputational, mm-hmm. you know, bust. And, you know, it appears that a lot of people swept a lot under the rug in those particular cases. And this is an example of the same thing.
Yeah. You know, one thing that in the spirit of lessons learned, I wonder, and I don't have the facts to say this is true, but I just wonder how many of those CEOs that I read about in the past 24 months who got themselves entangled in these harassment issues in particular, how many of them, when they were hired, received the training that their frontline employees receive? You could assume from the outcome that they didn't get the training they need. And we all know that notion that I'm too busy, I'm too important, that's for the little guy. But think about it, if you're running an organization and you are providing, here in Maine, it's required to provide sexual harassment training to your new hires and also to supervisors at certain points when they assume those responsibilities. If you're not taking the training yourself, you're not requiring it of the senior executive team, A, that doesn't look good, and B, when you get in these situations and it transpires that it didn't happen, then I think that's going to be a very bad day for a company in a courtroom or wherever else that's being debated. Because, you know, the simple argument is this person didn't get it. And one of the things we know and have learned about sexual harassment cases and other forms of harassment too, but particularly sexual harassment, very frequently there's this significant imbalance of power. There's the CEO or the senior executive, and frequently it's an assistant, an executive assistant. It's somebody who may work closely with them, but the power balance is very, very significant, and you know, that's been commonplace in many, many cases over the years.
We're talking with Peter Lowe. He's an appointment attorney with the law firm of Braun and Isaacson. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM. This is presented by CMAcareer.com and Dale Carnegie, Maine. And today we're talking with Peter Lowe. He's the employment attorney at Braun and Isaacson. Yes, I said the because he is a great guy. And disclosure, I know him. So, no, anyways, we're having a great time. We're talking about dealing with a company's reputation and lessons learned from Deflategate. So, you know, Peter, we've kind of talked the first half of the show about dealing with a reputation. You've taught us about football, the real game. And so that's all great. So now, as we get into the heart and the meat and potatoes, is we're going to talk about Deflategate and the lessons learned from it. And again, it really does talk about how our reputation can be everything.
It does. You know, maybe the show's not longer because I could have given you the history of rugby as well, but we'll do that. And we'll do that next time.
I can hardly wait. Hey, do you lacrosse as well?
No, just rugby.
Just rugby. Okay, just asking. Just also. All right, so Deflategate. Everybody, I think, here knows the story, so you don't have to necessarily tell the story, but maybe the highlights of why or where we're at this point.
Yeah. Number one, Deflategate is one of the most clear-cut examples why litigation is not an efficient or effective tool for addressing issues.
And can I just make a point? I know I'm going to jump in here. To think that this could go to the Supreme Court,
they
have things to do. I just wonder, really? It's amazing, really.
Yeah, I expect that's very unlikely, but I guess you never know. Where we're at, just in a sort of thumbnail sketch, because the Players Association is a union, and Tom Brady is a member of that, a lot of what happened is controlled by a collective bargaining agreement, just as teachers or firefighters would have an agreement. The NFL players have one. And so that controlled the initial stages of Deflategate. So when there were allegations arising about the AFC Championship game against the Colts and balls being deflated, the NFL investigated. The NFL then decided to discipline. The NFL then decided to hear Brady's appeal of the discipline. All of those actions were taken by the commissioner, Roger Goodell, or his surrogates. And when he finally concluded after Tom Brady's appeal hearing that he was going to suspend him for four games, there was an appeal then made of the arbitration decision of the commissioner to the courts. And so in the last 6 months, we've been following it through the courts, and Brady's team filed a request for the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in its entirety to hear the case, which happens in a minuscule number of cases. A little trivia, actually. Brady hired a new lawyer for the appeal. His name is Ted Olson. Ted Olson has an interesting background. This is a complete tangent, but interesting
fact. Unusual for you.
Very unusual for me. Ted Olson, tragically, his wife died in 9/11. He's one of the leading Supreme Court lawyers. He was the lawyer for Bush in the Bush-Gore cases. He was also the lawyer who took the same-sex marriage and won that case before the Supreme Court. So he's got an incredible reputation, and he signed on for the Brady team. So for those of us who are Brady fans, and unabashedly I'm one of those, are hoping that he can work his magic, but the odds are stacked against him. So that's where it currently stands in sort of the legal process, and it is remarkable to think how long and drawn out this has been. And you know, I have my own opinions about it, and I think the NFL, I'll display my subjectivity on this and my opinions. I think they've handled it extremely poorly. I think they've shown bias through this process. I don't think they've met the standards of fairness. But that doesn't mean that they won't win in the win-loss sense. Whether, in fact, anybody wins is a very debatable item, because think of reputations again. Certainly Tom Brady's reputation has been harmed outside of the New England area because of this. The NFL has had many reputational hits. I don't think this has helped their reputation. So you really do wonder about does anybody come out on top of this?
Well, and that's really the part that I always think about is, at the end, what's really going to be the legacy? What's really going to be, you know, the go-forward situation when you're dealing with an issue? Is it worth continuing to drag it on? Is it worth continuing to push it? I mean, yes. I mean, I think anybody would argue, or anybody that knows the court system knows, to get anything done in 6 months is a miracle, first of all. So that means that you can afford to move it through the court system in a faster way. And let's be honest, both sides have spent ridiculous amounts of money on this. And the only one that wins, sorry, is the lawyers, but you all agree. Yeah. It's the only one that wins on this.
Sure.
And so when a company's thinking about it, and you've said this before, principle is important, but there is a cost to principle, and you have to start debating the fact of where is it that you're willing to take. And as we get into the lessons learned here, you know, you have to think about what it is that really matters to you as an individual, right? And what matters to the company, and what's the best way to handle it?
Yeah. It is. It's an interesting dilemma for companies and individuals, but a company may feel that the allegations that are being brought against the company are so harmful and false that they have no choice but to defend themselves and hopefully prevail. That's can be a risky strategy, and it can be an expensive strategy, because lawyers will always tell you there's just no guarantees whatsoever in litigation. And I think the Tom Brady case, amongst many others, is a classic example of that. The judge, a well-respected Judge Berman, who was the trial court judge, if you like, in the federal court, issued a stinging rebuke of the NFL, if you read his decision. And he really came down and said that they had acted unfairly and didn't mince his words. The court that heard the appeal was divided 2-1 in favor of the NFL. And again, strong words on either side. You just don't know how different people are going to view a common set of facts. Lawyers who are doing their job will encourage two sides to work in mediation. Mediation is a confidential process where, you know, lawyers doing their job will seek to have their client reach, you know, a compromise, something that both sides can live with. And we spend a lot of time doing that on pretty much all of our cases. And it's no guarantee, but it certainly can be a less expensive and less draining and daunting process than the litigation one.
So as we're looking at this, you have six lessons that you have brought forward that our companies can look at and say, okay, hey, these are things we can learn from Deflategate. And these six lessons are, I'll start with the first one, is keep an open mind. I think that seems so obvious, Peter, but yet I guess it's not, is it?
It really isn't. And I think this comes to our human nature. And you know, sometimes I try to put myself into the shoes of, you know, the HR person or the manager or the supervisor who's investigating an issue. And you know, you may have an employee come forward who has a very poor reputation. They're hanging on by a thread to their job. There's been instances in the past of dishonesty. You may, in fact, think that they're coming forward with a complaint to be protective of their job. We've seen that in instances. Someone comes forward and says, you know, or presents themselves as a whistleblower, and it's 10 minutes before they're about to lose their job. It's easy for all of us to carry the biases we have about that person into an investigation. And if we do that, if we're unable to put those aside, we may often have an outcome that is unfavorable for the company and for the individuals. I have shared a case I worked on very, very recently where it involved some individuals where it was easy to come to the conclusion that one person was guilty, putting it simply, and I'll be mindful of confidentiality. And I think myself as the lawyer, HR, management, all had concluded that a person had done something. And it transpired that there was a videotape available. And, you know, we went to the tape and we saw the tape and it didn't happen. It was an alleged assault. It never happened. And I think all of us did a check and thought, wow, we went to the place of an assault quite readily, and we didn't perhaps keep the open mind that we should have kept. And the tape was irrefutable. It did not happen. And but for the tape, a person could have lost their job. So it's advice that can't be repeated often enough. And I think, you know, if you think about Deflategate, and I've talked about some other examples as well, very early on, there was information shared that the balls that the New England Patriots used were significantly deflated. And I'll avoid getting into PSI, pounds per square inch, too much, but that was the initial story. And ESPN ran with it. And it was a product, in fact, of an NFL leak. And the NFL didn't come forward and say that, in fact, is incorrect. I think many people believe that set the table for what happened subsequently. And it's very hard to keep an open mind once that type of information is out there. And, you know, a good investigator has to check themselves the entire time. And those of your listeners who have been involved in investigations and do them well will realize they start at point A, I think it's only human nature that we form some conclusions as we are developing a case. But they will have been surprised in the past, and suddenly things turn out to be quite different from how they've been presented. And I think that's crucial.
Yeah, no, I think that's a real important lesson. Lesson two is you say don't provide factual updates during an investigation. I would argue that that's not necessarily what I've heard in the past. And so explain that.
Yeah, I think as the investigator, if you are reporting to a senior vice president, let's say you're reporting to the CFO, and it's a high-profile investigation for the company, and you have to interview as many as 10 different people, I don't think there's anything that the CFO is doing wrong when he or she says, how's it going? Have you spoken with Dave yet? What did Dave say about this? The problem in my view is that the CFO, based on what you tell the CFO, may start to form her own conclusions. And I've had instances where the person in the CFO role reaches a conclusion that is different from the ultimate investigation conclusion. And you may have a person who's in the CFO role saying, he should definitely be terminated. It's based on incomplete information. It results in sometimes internal communications that suggest a decision has been made prematurely. And if our commitment is to be fair in an investigation, I think the investigator is better off saying, could give updates in terms of, I've now interviewed 5 people. Yes, I've interviewed Jim. I'm going to document all the information I've obtained, and I'll share the specifics once I've done my investigation. I realize that some people won't like that and won't want to do that. That's their choice. But my preferred practice, and I think there's good reason for it, is you, the investigator doesn't be sending out bulletins and updates within the organization.
No, that makes sense. Lesson three, you say manage the public discourse.
Yeah. And when I say public discourse, I'll give you another example of what I mean by that. I've seen situations, we represent school departments, for example, where a teacher may be placed on administrative leave, and that's necessary in that environment sometimes to make sure that everybody's protected. Sometimes the rumor mill, we talked about social media at the beginning, can just get out of control. And before you know it, there's an allegation that, you know, Jimmy's being put out on administrative leave because, you know, he assaulted somebody. I'm just making up an example. And you know that not to be true. And the difficulty that the client faces in that situation is, what do I say? Because if I speak to this, do I pour more fuel on the fire? On the other hand, if the rumor mill just gets out of hand, the poor guy who's out on administrative leave, the damage may be done. So, you know, my advice to clients, and they have to be very thoughtful about it, is there may be times where you see that people are spreading a rumor that you just know is not true, and you go straight to those folks and say, I can't share the details. This is a confidential matter, but the information that I see you're spreading, if you're discussed, that's not accurate, and it's not responsible to be sharing that type of information. The other sort of public discourse is when the story gets into the media, and there can be a tendency, no comment, confidential matter. And I think that way you're losing control over the discussion. And if there are items, again, that need to be addressed or corrected or clarified, I think people should do that more rather than less. There's a fine line to walk with confidentiality, so folks are going to, you know, want to get some advice about that. But that's the balancing act.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM. Presented by CMAKorea.com and Dale Carnegie, Maine. We are talking with Peter Lowe. He is the employment attorney at Brown & Isaacson. I really should say there are other great employee attorneys at Brown & Isaacson. Right, Peter?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
Good. But you're the guy. So you're the one at Brown & Isaacson, and we're excited to have you here. And you're talking about Deflategate, the story, and how companies can deal with their reputation. You're talking about lessons they can learn from it. So we've talked about keep an open mind. I think that was critical. Second, don't provide factual updates during investigation. Third was manage the public discourse. And now we're on number four, recognize when you need an outside investigator.
Yeah, I alluded to this a little earlier, that there are times where I think the internal investigator is put in a position that's untenable and there may be a conflict of interest. There may be such the allegations may be so serious. There's a variety of different circumstances, and I use that term outside investigator in the Deflategate case. The NFL referred to an independent investigator. It was a load of I can't swear on the radio, can I?
But no,
a load of I know you use another English term, tosh. It was a load of tosh. They hired their own law firm who played multiple roles representing the NFL throughout this, and certainly some of the judges who've reviewed this have said that that wasn't an independent investigation. If the NFL truly wanted to treat this fairly, and it's very high profile, it's the franchise player for the one of the biggest franchises and most successful franchises, they would have gone outside, truly outside. They wouldn't have gone to a law firm who they pay millions of dollars to. They would have gone to a separate law firm. They would have had an independent arbitrator. And those are all things that a company should think about carefully.
So the lesson five is what seems, again, kind of obvious. Attention to the details because they matter.
You know, the obvious things are the things we miss.
It's
true. It really
is
true, isn't it?
That is true. Very true.
I agree with you totally. I can give this is a very simple example. I mentioned earlier this deflator text. That was probably the most important term used throughout this whole Deflategate debacle. It was used by one of the ball boys. In a text, the NFL's investigators, which was a fleet or an army, maybe more accurately, of lawyers, who interviewed this gentleman, I believe, three separate occasions, never once asked what did he mean by that term, deflator. That was the obvious question. And translate that to HR for a minute. Sometimes I find the most critical allegations, and sometimes they're the most embarrassing ones, frankly, especially in a sexual harassment case, nobody asks, well, what did you mean by that? Or did you say that? Or did you grab that? Or did you whatever it is? And the investigation truly isn't complete and thorough and, frankly, fair without asking those questions. So it really does require you to get down into those details. And Deflategate was we believe a $3 million investigation. It appears they didn't ask some of the most crucial questions of witnesses.
Well, that goes to lesson six, of course. Be balanced, address all relevant facts.
Right. When I get an investigation report from a client, and I do frequently, I always look to see whether the client has included interviews with all witnesses, and that would include the witness who may be telling facts that are contrary to your ultimate conclusions. And if those aren't included, immediately it raises a red flag. If they're not discussed, it, or immediately raises a red flag. I like the cases or the investigations where I see that the investigator has spoken with everybody who might have relevant information, good, bad, or indifferent, has reached a conclusion, and perhaps explained. I spoke with Dave. In fact, Dave described that he never saw any inappropriate groping, and he said he was right there. I'm not going to bury that somewhere. I'm not going to not address it. I'm going to discuss it and explain, I didn't find Dave credible. This is why. Or, in fact, Dave wasn't in the position to have seen the conduct. Deal with it. Address it. And, frankly, in this sprawling, long Deflategate report, they attempt to do some of that. But I think, again, it came across to me as a report written that was more of an advocacy piece for an outcome that they desired, more like a lawyer's brief than what we would look like for a true, thorough outside investigation.
As we wrap up here on the last minute, the last thing that you talk about is to be fair, right? To make sure that fair is a relative term, isn't it? And so how do you think companies should feel about, you know, making things fair?
Yeah, it's a broad question, and there's a lot of comment I could have on it. I ultimately think, and I've said this to many clients, when you make a decision, let's use a termination decision by way of example, which is one of the most serious decisions you can make. You're ending someone's employment, sometimes their career, not always, but sometimes. And there's lots of risk factors that go with that. Is the person in a certain age? Are they in a protected class of race? What was the performance? How are we treating other people? You know, all of those things, very relevant, important questions. What's in their personnel file? But I always like to think there's a sort of a gut test as well. And is this fair? Is this how I would want to be treated? Is this how I'd want a family member to be treated? Have we shown respect to this person? Are we treating them with the dignity that they deserve? And that's an intangible, but I believe we all have that fairness barometer. And in the end, I will often say to a client, all right, you know, we've talked through all the ups and downs. What do you think is fair? Tell me what you think is fair and why do you think that's fair? So that can, I think, be one way of putting one's arms around this somewhat vague and amorphous concept. So we know it when we see it. And I think our guts play a really important role. HR people are professionals. Judgment that they use is one of the critical aspects, and a big part of judgment is how do I be fair? How do I be balanced?
We've been talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney, Bron Isaacson, and he's been talking about protecting your company's reputation and lessons you can learn from Deflategate. Peter, thank you for being on the show today.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks
and
for inviting
we'll have
me.
You back again. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.